Hey, welcome back to Caffeine and Questions. Put this out a couple of weeks ago. Got a bunch of questions, but I've been crazy busy, so I got to it today, a couple of weeks later. The first part of this, I'm going to answer some gun questions. If you're not a gun person, you can skip ahead. I get a lot of gun questions. And honestly, somebody sent me a link to one of those gun forums. And there's a lot of people with questions, and there are a lot of people answering questions that really don't know what they're doing. All right, so I'm going to address a couple of sniper-specific opinions, and then we'll get to more general topics. The first one is sniper logbooks. Somebody asked me, do snipers still use logbooks? I have not seen a logbook in the U.S. military since about 2008 because the ballistic calculator came on board, and logbooks are a thing of the past. So if you're on YouTube, I'll show you. This is a sniper logbook right here. And it's kind of old school. And if you go in there, there's all kinds of ways to mill targets, to measure targets. There's tons and tons of data. And then what we used to have to do was we used to have to go through the range before the ballistic calculator. And we would have to, like, if you look at one of these pages, it's place, date, time, scope, ammunition, temperature, distance, corrected dope, altitude, humidity, barometric pressure, mirage. And then you write in all your shots. And then sometimes there's a little target here that you draw, and you go where you hit and all that. If you want to do that, that's what does it for you, go ahead. But I have not seen a sniper data book in almost 20 years in the U.S. military. 15 anyway, because the ballistic calculator came on board, right? So this is my logbook right now. I'm holding up a Kestrel ballistic computer and a Garmin chronograph, right? With this, I can get all my data in 5 minutes. So when we were, before we had these things, we would gather data. We would go to 100 meters and zero. And then we go back to 150 and we're gathering data and taking note of the drop in those atmospheric conditions, right? And then we go back to 200 or 250 and 300 where you'd spend weeks gathering data, and you come out on a sunny day and a rainy day. And so what used to take weeks of gathering data takes 5 minutes now. Zero, chrono, go to work, right? So if you're taking a long-range course and you're required to buy a data book, I would be hesitant, right? I'm not here to bash anybody else's course, but I have seen packing lists for courses where they want you to have a data book. And because what you're doing is you're spending a lot of time and burning a lot of bullets gathering data. When you can gather your data in 5 minutes, now you're spending time shooting, learning how to call wind, learning how to shoot in alternate positions, learning how the gun works, learning instead of gathering data, right? So I remember in 2008 or 2009, we were on the range, and I came back to the team room at sniper school, and I said, the data book is dead. It's a thing of the past. And the old school guys were pissed, and I'm sure people are going to be pissed when they hear me say that. Again, I teach currently for the Marine Corps Special Operations Sniper Course. I'm an instructor, and they don't have data books. They have Kestrel, they have chronograph, and then they have wrist coach on their wrist or something on their rifle with all their data. You don't. This Kestrel is a tool. It's not a crutch. I'm not sitting on the side of a mountain in a foreign country playing with my Kestrel trying to get my dope. I get there, I update atmospherics, and I put it all on a wrist coach or on my rifle. And between max point blank and speed drop and stuff like that, I already know my data anyway. But that's what snipers do now. And that's not opinion. That's a fact. The Cold War theory. Here's another one that pisses people off, right? Cold War theory is the theory that when you get behind your rifle and it hasn't been shot and the barrel is cold, then your first shot is going to shift, you know, 0.2, 0.3 high, left, right, down, and you can account for that. And then when you're shooting off a warm barrel, it'll go back to where it's supposed to go. Theoretically, you would, if you were taking that cold bore shot, you would take that into account, so you punch the target exactly where you want to punch it. So I've been tracking cold bore for decades, like 30 freaking years almost. And I've been trying to pick up a pattern, and I've never, ever, ever seen a pattern that was consistent enough that I would actually dial it if I had to take a low percentage shot on a hostage target, right? And it was very interesting. The first time I went to the Marine Corps sniper course as an instructor, one of the classes was Cold War theory. And I was like, I have my opinion. I just want to see what these guys say, because the Marine Corps are very, very good at what they do, and they have great instructors. And the senior non-commissioned officer in the Marine Corps got up there and he said, Cobor theory is a theory. That's all it is. Right? And I've done classes with a lot of people, like law enforcement. I'm like, who has a Cobor shift? Some guys put their hand up and I say, what is it? Well, it's like 0.2 right. And I say, how many times have you shot that on a Cobor? Well, once or twice. That's not a consistent enough pattern. And I said, would you dial that on if you had a low percentage shot? And they're like, no. And I'm, well, you don't have a Cobor shift. Now, maybe your rifle, you're listening to this, does, but it has to do it every time the same amount, and you have to be able to track that. And I just think there's too many variables in there. People say it's actually a cold shooter. They say that, look, the gun's not, it's not warm, but it's not fouled, and it's not, you know, there's atmospheric conditions and all these different variables. Cobor theory, I have never, ever, ever in my 30 plus years of experience seen it consistent enough that I would actually dial it on or hold it on a low percentage shot. Okay. Another one I love is barrel break-in procedures, right? So what they used to say for breaking in a barrel, they used to say, get it and, you know, take it in range, shoot one shot and then clean it like with a cleaning rod. And get all the carbon out of it and then take another shot and clean it. Take another shot and you do this for 5 or 10 or 15 rounds, whatever the procedure is. I don't really know the procedure in detail because I've never done it. And then you shoot 5 rounds and you clean it for a certain number of rounds. And then you shoot more. And after like so many rounds, you've broken in the barrel. My opinion, BS. Okay, complete BS. And when I got to the Force Mod office, and I had lots and lots of experience in sniper operations and running a school, sniper school, when I got to the Force Mod office at the tail end of the PSR, which died, the company that had won that contract were trying to charge us for breaking in the barrels. Number one, you're burning our barrels out. No, these are combat arms, right? These are combat sniper rifles. They arrive in a truck and they get put on a Connex and they get sent to war, right? So here's what I do if I have a brand new barrel. I just go shoot, okay? So it'll take about, generally, it'll take about between, and guns are different, 20 to 50 rounds to get that gun really, really tight because you're filling in imperfections in the barrel, okay? So you might have a 2 minute of angle group and then you keep shooting and it tightens, tightens, tightens. It's the same thing when I take my precision guns and I clean them really, really well. The first couple of groups are going to be a little scattered and then it will tighten up and it'll shoot half a minute of angle at 100 meters, right? So that's what I consider breaking in the barrel, those first 30, but I'm shooting groups, I'm training. Right, I'm working my position and all that. Your muzzle velocity, the speed the bullet comes out of the barrel is going to climb for about the first 100 rounds, 150 maybe, and then it'll stop and it will stay there until the barrel is shot out. Okay, it'll fluctuate with lot numbers of ammo and stuff like that, but that's your muzzle velocity. So that's the two things you got to deal with. You got to deal with the gun won't group initially very well until you shoot 30, 40, 50 rounds. Sometimes it's less, and then the muzzle velocity will climb to about 100 rounds, 150, and then it'll stop, okay? I love these test videos where guys go out to test the rifle and just start shooting groups all. It's not going to group. Generally, it's not going to group. And when you clean it really, really, really well, it won't group. When I went to sniper school, we had different blocks. We'd shoot the M24s. We'd shoot them for a week or 9 days or whatever, and we wouldn't clean them. We went down, but we never rod the barrel because I don't want to mess up my data. And then when that portion was over, we'd clean them really well. And then we'd go to gas guns or 300 Win Mags, and then we'd run those all the way through and we clean it at the end, and then we go to gas guns, right, and we'd run those all the way through and clean it at the end, right? So that's logbooks, Cobor theory, and barrel break-in procedures. Feel free to disagree with me, I really don't care. That is my experience and my opinion. Somebody asked why thermal clip-ons, if you put a thermal clip-on on a bar, on a rail, why it shifts your zero? Because it's putting weight on the rail. And anything that put weight on that rail, which is generally just attached at the back, is going to shift your zero slightly. Okay? Again, a zero shift for a suppressor or a clip-on night vision optic is not a big deal as long as it's predictable and repeatable, right? If I throw it on there and it always moves, you know, down 0.2 or up 0.2 or whatever, and as long as that's predictable, I can dial that in and account for it right off the bat. All right, gun stuff. Somebody asked about combat load in combat. in combat, generally the load in the US military is 7 magazines, right? 7 30 round magazines, 210 rounds. Some guys carried more. I never carried less. And mags are generally not topped off to 30 rounds. I used to put like 28 in them because when you put them too tight and you load it into a weapon with the bolt forward, it's a bit of a squeeze. And I'll tie this into another question about what kind of ammo. The military issued 855 ammo, right? And then they went to 855A1. 855 was green tip ammo. It had a tungsten penetrator on it. It was used to punch through certain things like car engines and stuff like, not through, but they damaged them. Car doors. And it's not bullet, it's not armor piercing, but it has a penetration part in it. Problem is when you hit people with that, it punched right through. A lot of guys would run that and then 77 grain in the same mag, so it alternates, so you get the best of both worlds. And yep, the ballistics are different, vastly different, but you're shooting in the city, so it's short range stuff. And somebody asked about 9mm ammo while I'm on that. The Army issued 124 grain 9mm. And then with the Mark, all guns in the Army come with ammo, right? So if you get a, you know, the SCAR Heavy, that came with the 77 grain round, right? So when you get guns from the Army, even in SOCOM, you get all the bullets to come with it. So they issued, when the M17 came on board, they started issuing 115 grain ball for that gun. And then they had some 147 grain hollow point, right? Open tip. So that's what we ran in the military, and it was fine. We went on this roundabout, in probably in the world, but in the US military from like 38. You know, the 38 was being used in the US military, and then the 45 came on board in 1911 when the American military went to the Philippines fighting these tribesmen, and they needed more stopping power, right? So they brought on the 45, and then we went to 9mm. 9mm is a Second World War round. And then we went to 357 and 40 cal and 10mm and back to 9mm. And, you know, by all the ballistic reports I've read, that 9mm is where it's at. There's trade-offs in everything, right? There's people swear by 45 ammo. Good for you. But 9mm as a combat weapon for a soldier is probably about right, I think, in my opinion. Okay, so combat loader, 210 rounds. Now, generally when I load my body armor up, all my mags went to the left side because I load my left hand and I keep my rifle in my right hand. But depending on the mission, the gear changed slightly depending on the type of mission you were doing. Doing a lot of building climbing, doing a lot of urban moving through cities and stuff like that, we tend to lighten it down a little bit, but ammo never got left behind. I remember we got those, you know, between body armor, ammo for rifle, pistol ammo, frag grenades, flashbangs, breaching charges, breaching shotgun, med kit, trauma shears, compass, chem light, flex cuff, tourniquet, all that stuff on your kit with body armor, with soft armor and plates gets a little heavy, right? Now, when I went through Sephardic, which is our 9-week CQB hostage rescue school, I wore Paraclete body armor. I had all that kit on every day, and it was like a t-shirt at the end. It meant nothing, you know? And the same with combat. You get very used to it. But if you take any more weight, it can get a little cumbersome. So in 2005, I think it was, they issued with these H&K, like steel magazines that were supposed to be super rugged and robust, and we all put them on because we all thought they were great. And they were, each magazine was heavier than the regular M4 mag. And I remember I did a mission where we were running and gunning all night long, climbing buildings, jumping over rooftops and all that kind of stuff. And by the end of it, I went back and dumped all those mags, put my old mags back in because I didn't want the extra weight. Okay, now I'll say every now and again, you'll see these Too Cool for School soft guys and they have a tomahawk on their kit, right? If I ever see, I only saw it once in real life, but I've seen pictures of it. That guy's an idiot. He's a jackass and he's a child and he needs, his supervisor should slap him and took that crap off. I don't know what the range of a tomahawk is or the firepower, but I guarantee you, if I'm dropping 3 mags to put a tomahawk in my kit, 90 rounds of 5.56 is a lot more firepower than a freaking tomahawk. Why would you ever use that? It's just, it was this childish thing that was going on at a certain point. Not so much in the Army, but in other places. So that's a combat load. Generally 2 mags for your pistol, but a pistol's a backup for us. We lived with M4s in our hands. Somebody asked me about the Garmin Chrono. That's this here. I did a whole video on it, guys. Yes, not sponsored by anybody. Garmin Chrono is a phenomenal piece of kit. I'm pushing through here. Would you come to Ireland and do a shooting course? Love to. Pay for my travel. Judging distance at longer ranges. That's a great one. So how do you judge distance at long ranges? It's freaking hard. So I've been judging distance my whole military career by eye, milling targets and range finding. And I thought I was pretty good at it. And I'm pretty decent at it if it's a flat surface, right? Because there's all these techniques to teach in the military. How many football fields between you and the target? Pick a midpoint and a double A. There's all these things you can do. The last time I was out in Utah in the mountains in Dugway Proving Ground, working for the Marine Corps, we were up in this big mountaintop and we were having this discussion with one of the instructors. He said, like, I think judging distance by eye past like 400's BS. And I was like, I don't know, I think I'm pretty decent at it. He's like, okay, let's test it. And we picked the peak of a hill, right, uphill on a mountain. And he's like, what do you think that is? And I looked and I was like, I said something like 425 or something like that. And we hit a rangefinder and it was like 290. Not even close. Not even like a miss if you fired at that, all right? So I was like, damn, I suck, you know? But in that rough terrain, it's so much harder. When there's nothing out there to compare it to with size and all that kind of thing, it's easier a flat surface in the streets when you look at the cars and people and you know the height of them. So judging distance by eye is difficult, to say the least. Somebody asked as well about judging wind. At extreme range, right? How do you do that? You do it with a wing and a prayer, right? You try to judge wind. I have a whole class on this in my 2-day class, but you're judging wind based on a ton of different factors. And then you, even if there's clean wind at your position, you can get a wind call with your Kestrel. But then you're reading terrain and looking at what the terrain is doing to the wind by the time it gets to the target, right? And then you're looking at mirage, you're looking at freaking birds flying, you're looking at grass moving and vegetation and all kinds of stuff, and then you're hedging your bets and you're making the smartest wind call you can based on the width of the target, and then you're ready for a second shot correction if you need it. It's difficult and it takes a lot of training, a lot of practice, but there are ways to do it. The hardest place I think I've shot, I've been in a bunch of tough places, but anywhere where you're shooting across a valley and you have no way to read the wind in between you and the target, that's freaking difficult. And even with a lot of experience, it's difficult. But there's almost no shortcut. They're working on wind sense technology and SOCOM have been for years, where you shoot a laser and it goes on, it reads all the terrain and comes back and gives you a wind call. Not there yet. Technology's not there. But God bless, maybe someday. But you have to learn the old school way too, in case it goes down. Same thing with a Kestrel, right? You got to be able to shoot, got to be able to gather data. All right, so are we headed for civil war? No, we're not headed for civil war, guys. It's not that bad. And people are like, civil war? They've never been in a war, probably. You know who suffers in a civil war, in any war? This is the civilian population. It's your mom, your dad, your grandparents, your little brother, little sister, and the people you love. That's who suffers mostly. So we're not anywhere near there yet. I think what happens is people get bombarded by negativity on the news and on social media, and they let it get them. Because I used to be that guy. I used to devour the news every day. And then, you know, the news media has cut us into two sections and they keep us fighting with each other. I don't like giving away secrets or anything, but when I was in SEER school, they separated all. When I was in prison, they separated the class by religion. Protestants over here, Catholics over here, Mormons over here. And then they systematically destroyed your religion, right? But the answer is, you don't let them separate you. You don't let them separate you by religion. You stay as a unit together in formation and you're stronger that way. But the public in America have been completely separated. And if you allow it, if you're a conservative and you devour Fox News every day, it's some of these issues are serious. I'm not saying they're not, right? Gun control, immigration, all these things. A lot of them you can't do anything about right now, right, till November. But if you're constantly being bombarded by them, it just seems like the world is coming to an end. And social media too, right? If you go on YouTube, and one of the reasons my YouTube channel is not growing fast is I refuse to do clickbait, number one, right? If you go and look at some of the channels that you follow and subscribe to, if there's clickbait, everything, the end is nigh, bring out your dead, like just this World War III, this, that, every day it's a new thing. They're using you. They're using you for subscriptions and likes and follows so they can get sponsorship, right? And they're telling you what you want. If people don't go to the news for information, they go for affirmation, right? To affirm what they already knew was going on, all this stuff, right? But I would say if you want to be happier, turn that freaking news off. And it doesn't mean you won't be informed, but you can find, you're still going to find out what's going on. I never watch the news, but I still know what's going on because I pick my sources. And then anytime clickbait pops on my YouTube and it's very, very obvious what it is, delete it, right? I remember I did a video about how to zero your rifle, and the media guy at the time was like, you need to change the name, change it to "you suck at zeroing your rifle" or "your rifle is not zero." And I'm like, I'm not doing that. I'm just not, you know, arrogance, right? Go and delete all that clickbait right now. Unsubscribe and get rid of them. Get them out of your life. Stop watching the news and getting mad and thinking the world is going to end any day now, and get on with your life. You've only got one. Social media is a double-edged sword, right? But you got to control it, right? I use Instagram, podcast, YouTube to try and sell training when I do. I don't do that much training. I'd like to do more. But if you put some, I put something on Instagram and I, you know, you ask a rhetorical question, you know. I did one recently about, I was at the National Infantry Museum and it has all the names of all the people killed in the GWAT. And I said, I can't find one politician's name. Now, I wasn't suggesting that Joe Biden throw on body armor and go out there and fight, right? It was a rhetorical question to make a point. But people still feel the need to educate me that in a democracy, and we're actually not a democracy, a constitutional republic, but, you know, they don't do that. And that, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, you think I'm a fucking idiot, right? So you can't try to be funny on social media. Sometimes you can't put a rhetorical question on there because douchebags want to educate you. And then, you know, if you look at some of these people's lives on social media, you just think they have a great life. It's all fake. It's all fake. Don't compare your real life to somebody else's fake life. And it's, I assume it's very hard for young people now with all the friends and all that, and they're all doing cool stuff, but it's all fake. Like if a company wants, that's why I'm not sponsored by anybody, right? If I tell you, I'm about to look at this thing here. I'm about to look at this Impact 4000 that Kestrel put out, right? And I didn't buy it. I borrowed it from a friend of mine. It's a ballistic calculator, mounts on the rifle. Whatever. I will not endorse it unless it's good. But if it's good, I will let you know that it's a great piece of kit. And I'm going to buy one myself if it's a good piece of kit. But I don't want to endorse anything. I'm not paid by anybody. But all these companies, and they all do it, they want to get buzz going with their new gun, their new optic, their new this, that, the other. Across the board, they'll push it out to other influencers who are paid to push that thing. And it might look like a legitimate test, but it says paid promotion on it. And they're paid to push that piece of equipment on you, and it freaking works. The thing I struggle with, honestly, is marketing. Because I refuse to be, if you want to be successful on social media these days, as a guy in my field, you have to put Green Beret in every sentence, Special Operations, Navy SEAL, and then talk down to people like, I know more than you, blah, blah, and I just refuse to do that. You want to be a female in this world? Like if you can be like really proficient, like Kirsten Morgan, really good shot, very experienced, great instructor. But unless you have a certain look on the range, you're just not getting there. But we're okay with that. We're okay the way we are. And I believe we have credibility that other people don't have, even if we don't have the following. Anyway, let me look. I got a bunch of repeat questions. Somebody wrote, tell us a funny story. So I'll end with that. My wife does that to me. She turned the camera on. She'd be like, tell me a funny story. And I'll be like, I got nothing. I got TBI. But I have a good long-term memory, but my short-term memory is terrible. But and I can't remember if I told this before. So if I did, you can just go ahead and tune out. I was training a guy in Ireland one time. I was training a group of corporate leaders. We were doing all kinds of outdoor stuff with them. And we were hiking up this big mountain. And this guy was struggling, right? He ain't been out of the boardroom lately. And so I was trying to talk to him and engage him, take his mind off the hike. And he was telling me that, I was asking him where he was from. He's from the south of Ireland and he grew up in a little village and all that. But he told me his grandfather still lives there. And his grandfather has this routine. He's a widower. Wife died like 20 years ago and he lives alone, a little cottage, and he's like 3 miles from the village. And he has this routine every Saturday night. He gets on his bicycle and he rides down the bike down to the village. And he goes in, he drinks like 10 pints of Guinness and he gets a little bottle of vodka, Nagin, I think they call him, a little bottle, and he puts it in his hip pocket and in his ass cheek, and he rides back up the hill. When he gets back to his cottage, he drinks his bottle of whiskey and he passes out. And he walks up there. He does this every Saturday night, has for years. Well, one night he goes down, does his routine, gets his 10 pints, getting on there, and he's riding his bike back up the hill, and he falls off, and he lands on the the bottle, and it shatters and puts all these glass shards in his butt cheek, right? So he goes into his house, he walks home the rest of the way, he goes in, he stands in front of the mirror and he picks all the glass out, drunk off his ass. It's pretty impressive. And then he gets a dressing and he puts a dressing on it and completely covers the wound, and he's satisfied with it and he goes to bed. Wakes up the next morning, bed's covered blood, sheets are stuck to the wound, and he can't figure out what happened. And then he looked over and he had put the dressing on the mirror instead of on his butt cheek when he was standing in front of the mirror trying to dress the wound. So that's what alcohol does. God bless alcohol. It serves a purpose. But all right, guys, looking at some more courses coming up soon. Stay tuned. We'll push out the newsletter. I'm about to go work for the Marine Corps for 2 months, but I'm going to try to get a couple of classes in between. Ran a very successful class in Charlotte, pistol class. Kirsten Morgan is doing private classes on pistol and carbine. I do private classes on long range shooting, if you know anybody looking to get into that kind of sport. And I also do Zoom calls to do ballistics. I've done leadership, I've done acquisitions, kind of consulting on acquisitions of government contracts in person and over Zoom call. So a lot of stuff going on, a lot more coming. Thank you so much for supporting the channel, and I'll see you next time.